Welcome to The Balance, a public health podcast brought to you by the BC Alliance for Healthy Living. I'm Selena Ho, Manager of Communications and Projects. On this episode of The Balance, we'll be focusing on an extremely relevant topic, food insecurity within the province and the country, and how COVID-19 has only intensified this very important issue. With me here today is Valerie Tarasuk, a professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto. Valerie also leads PROOF, a research program that investigates policy interventions to reduce food insecurity in Canada. Thank you so much for joining us here today on The Balance, Valerie.
Thank you.
First, let's just start with some of the basics. Can you give us an overview of what food insecurity is and how it's intrinsically linked with financial insecurity?
So the way that we have come to define food insecurity in our work is as inadequate or insecure access to food due to financial constraints. So people not being able to afford the food that they need. And so just by virtue of the fact that almost all of us in Canada get our food by buying it, and the questions that ask about food insecurity and the monitoring that happens in Canada focus very much on a lack of food because of a lack of money to buy food. It makes sense then that those who are most affected will be those without money. The issues of inadequate and insecure income and inadequate and insecure food go hand in hand.
And Valerie, how can being food insecure impact a person physiologically and mentally on a day-to-day basis and also in the long term?
We know a lot about the relationship between food insecurity and health. And I mean, obviously it's a very stressful situation, but one of the things that is important to think about and thinking about why is such a potent social determinant of health is that by the time somebody is having trouble affording the food they need, they're struggling to afford other things as well. So as soon as we scratch the surface, we see that they're worried about being able to pay their rent. They may already be behind in their rent. If they have a mortgage, they're probably behind in that. You know, they've got huge pressure on them in terms of maintaining their housing because of their lack of money. Also, you know, they're very likely to be behind on payments for utility bills or internet telecommunications. If they have prescription medications, which many of them will, because most adults in food insecure households in Canada have been diagnosed with at least one chronic condition. So it goes hand in hand with poor health. So if they have prescription medications, again, they're very likely not to be filling them or not to be taking them as prescribed if there's any cost associated with those prescriptions. So it's just a cascade of things that are happening, right? We identify someone as food insecure because they tell us they're struggling to afford the food they need. But as soon as we look closer, we think that's actually somebody living in a situation where they're experiencing pervasive material deprivation and the stress that goes with that. So how does it affect their health? Well, there are some studies that show that, for example, in Canada, children exposed to severe food insecurity, so in households where they actually went hungry because there wasn't enough food or money for food, years later, they are more likely to have been diagnosed with chronic conditions like asthma and depression, things that they're going to have to manage for the rest of their lives. So children exposed to severe circumstances like this, absolutely, it leaves an indelible mark on their health. For adults, we also know that adults in extreme food insecure situations, you know, when followed over time, are more likely to develop diabetes. They're much, much, much more likely to report depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts. They're more likely to end up in the hospital or in an emergency department. Their profound effect on healthcare costs associated with this issue. What's happening for the individual in the household is if they have chronic diseases already, they're less able to manage them. So they're more likely to derail, right? Those conditions will get out of control. So they'll turn up in an emergency department because their diabetes is out of control because they can't manage it. Or they'll be there because their depression is out of control because they can't manage it. So there's that piece happening. They're less able to manage, but then the other piece is they're more likely to develop new things that are bad because they're in such dire straits. So this is a very, very serious problem from a health perspective.
Wow, just bringing up all those points, you really see how food insecurity is just the beginning marker that points to all these other major identifying health factors associated with the stress and the living conditions that that a person may have just been systemically conditioned in. And you know what? This is so relevant, especially for right now with pandemic going on too. So kind of just take facts that you just mentioned and bringing into a more timely topic. We're just going to talk about how food insecurity and COVID-19 are linked right now too. In that case, right before COVID-19, there were 4.4 million Canadians who were food insecure. We see in the data that prior to COVID, most people who are food insecure are employed. So Valerie, this gap in the system, it seems to allow people to be food insecure while being employed. Can you explain this discrepancy? It's something that I think the general public would think is a contradiction.
Well, yeah, I think so too. A lot of people have the idea that, you know, the best protection against poverty is a job, right? But sadly, over time in Canada, that's not true. We've got a lot of people in the workforce that are working short-term, part-time, contingent work, or the precarious workers. Perhaps they're low wage, but also they don't have full-time employment, and they certainly don't have benefits. They're set up in a way to have very insecure income and probably inadequate income. Layered onto that is the issue of workers in those circumstances trying to support themselves and others with their wages. One study done looking at the relationship between food insecurity and work, and it was a few years ago, but it identified these issues of short-term, part-time work, but also the idea of one person or a couple of people in low-wage jobs, perhaps part-time or seasonal, but trying to feed the mouths of several. Right? So a household depending on those wages and then people not being able to manage. It's partly a story of minimum wage. That's absolutely part of the issue here. But on top of that is the amount of work that people have and the fact that it's not full-time, that it's not secure, that they can't plan from one month to the next in terms of knowing how much they're going to make. And they're not in situations where they've got any kind of benefits. I mean, we've heard a lot through COVID-19 about sick days, but also I mentioned earlier the issue of prescription medications. Workers who are so vulnerable that they would show up in our studies as being food insecure, at risk of food insecurity, are also very unlikely to have pharmacare or other sorts of benefits that would help them to manage.
Wow. Just those topics of food insecurity and that inadequate income is further highlighted with the pandemic right now. Yeah. And yeah, how we see the job insecurity just inflating here. Recently, Valerie, a Statistics Canada survey done in the early stages of COVID-19 did show that 1 in 7 Canadians were food insecure, with higher rates of food insecurity being reported among households with children. So this is 19% compared to 12%. What issues around food security has the pandemic further highlighted?
Well, I think one of the things it's highlighted is the precarity of work. Right? The same Statistics Canada report that you're referencing also shows a much, much higher rate of food insecurity among people who have lost their jobs or are worried about losing them. We've seen that there are a whole lot of people in the workforce that were probably just hanging on. And yes, the federal government moved quickly to institute CERB. From the statistics that we've seen and the other kinds of reports, it looks like there are a whole lot of people for whom either the CERB wasn't enough, or they weren't able to access it because there are lots of rules and regulations in terms of getting to it. We also have people who didn't lose their work enough to qualify for CERB, so carried on working, but still in, you know, part-time positions. I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting is the way that some major food retailers instituted pandemic pay, right? They have been paying their workers very low wages. Examples, Loblaws and Walmart, not setting people up in jobs that were full-time secure positions. So when the pandemic hit and the federal government implemented CERB, those companies had no choice but to put money on the table to keep people working for them. But, you know, it's telling that they could find money at that point. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we were to survey those workers, if we'd still find many of them to be food insecure, that their personal costs rose through that time and continue to rise, as all of us do. You know, basic necessities have become more expensive, particularly, you know, we're hearing reports now about the increasing price of food. Life has become more expensive because of the complications associated with trying to practice physical distancing. So there's a lot going on. Whether they've lost work or whether they still are in work, we could assume that the low-wage workers who were at risk of food insecurity pre-pandemic are still struggling. And I think it's not fully evidenced in the most recent Statistics Canada survey, but it's certainly the findings that are presented there hint at those particular pockets of vulnerability in our society.
Yes, precisely. The pandemic really exaggerates, or I guess just brings more to light how the job market and that insecurity within employment, full-time versus part-time or just casual work, not having those benefits can really impact someone financially, and then further down the road, food insecure, on top of many other factors and consequences as well. And I think that's one of the things that the pandemic is really good at making everyone face at this point, is how we are all in positions, or most of us are in positions, to be at that insecurity point within finances and food. And just based on some of those statistics that were mentioned, we have seen that the federal government provide the number of Canadians who are food insecure. But here in BC specifically, Valerie, what does that data look like around food insecurity?
Well, the survey that was done most recently during the pandemic is too small to identify patterns within individual provinces, right? It's really just a very small snapshot of the problem, just enough to kind of serve as a lightning rod to, you know, highlight the fact that food insecurity appears to have increased since the pandemic. In British Columbia, the most recent data that we've got comes from the 2017-18 Canadian Community Health Survey. And in that survey, I think it's a little more than 12%, 12.4% of British Columbians, I believe, were food insecure at that point. It certainly is a problem in British Columbia. I mean, one of the things that also is a problem in British Columbia is their monitoring. Food insecurity has been, for many years now, measured on this very large survey called the Canadian Community Health Survey that is administered by Statistics Canada. And it runs over a two-year period, which is why the results that I just mentioned for British Columbia, I said it was 2017-18. So the information about 12.4% of households in British Columbia being food insecure is over those data collection that spanned those 2 years. On alternate cycles of the Canadian Community Health Survey, the food insecurity module is optional. And British Columbia doesn't always choose to measure food insecurity. So we've recently learned, for example, that this next survey, the Statistics Canada was running in 2019 and 20, the province of British Columbia opted out of measuring food insecurity on that cycle. So we don't have data from that cycle yet, but when we do, there's going to be a big black hole where British Columbia should be because they chose not to measure it. And make sure your listeners know, British Columbia was the only jurisdiction in the country that did that. Right? Most, and it's the second time in recent memory that they have chosen not to measure food insecurity. They also opted out of measurement in 2013-14. So it's a bit worrisome, right? I mean, British Columbia certainly is not immune to the problems of food insecurity. And we would imagine that, like other parts of Canada, food insecurity rates probably have risen through the pandemic. But when you turn the lights out on a problem, it makes it hard to see that problem and hard to tackle it. And so it's concerning. I don't know what the decision-making process was in British Columbia that would have caused them to, again, in this most recent cycle of the Canadian Community Health Survey, opt out of measuring food insecurity, but I would want to know that answer.
Valerie, based on your experiences with data collection, I'm just kind of going back to what you're saying about turning that light off for those past 2 years of that missing data. What are the consequences of not measuring this data for the past 2 years and right now?
Well, one of the consequences is that we have no ability to see whether new programs or changes to existing programs implemented by the province are making things better or worse, right? There's no ability to evaluate or to monitor the effects of policy decisions in British Columbia because there's no data. So, and that matters because with studies within other provinces, we've been able to see very strong effects of things like a change in social assistance benefit levels or an improvement in minimum wages. Everything that we and others have done looking at this problem of food insecurity in Canada suggests that it's very sensitive to policy interventions. So if the province makes a change that affects the incomes of people who are at the bottom of the income spectrum, whether it affects them positively or negatively, it's very likely to surface in the food insecurity data. But without that information, nobody can see it. You could say, well, they have other ways of evaluating these policies. Well, Do they really? I mean, often we've seen that simply looking at the rate of low income doesn't tell you as much about the experiences of people who are struggling as the measure of food insecurity does. I mean, it's an experience-based measure of material deprivation. So it really does put information on the table that you can't get just from looking at income statistics or shifts in the income distribution in British Columbia. I would argue that it leaves a big, big gap in knowledge there. Also for people working in the health system, I mean, we know that food insecurity is a potent social determinant of health and that people who are food insecure are much, much more likely than others to show up in the healthcare system. If the province were on top of the data, they would be perhaps able to forecast and plan and monitor the relationship between food insecurity and health and healthcare utilization in their province in ways that perhaps would enable them to better meet the needs of what is inarguably a very, very vulnerable population. To not ask these questions, you have years of gaps in data in the province. I mean, it really suggests that whoever is in charge doesn't see this as a problem or doesn't see this as an important one or isn't really interested in trying to reduce it, which is, you know, again, you'd monitor it if you wanted to see those numbers come down because you'd be watching them and you'd be caring whether they went up or down depending on whatever changes you made. So this is a very, very troubling sign. And as I say, this is the only province in Canada that has such a stellar record of discounting or dismissing the idea of measurement right now. No one else through 2019-20 omitted food insecurity from their measurement.
That's a very significant insight into how this major data gap plays into the rest of our systems and our programs and eventually trickles down into the individual and then collective experience. Like you said, we have ways to measure the income, but that does not reflect at all in terms of food insecurity and the livelihood of those who have, maybe they have income, but that doesn't equate to their quality of living. I think it's really interesting how you pointed out that people who are food insecure using that measure specifically are more likely to enter the healthcare system. Lots of gaps in the data for sure. Valerie, just based on a lot of those limitations that you have noticed, what recommendations would you make to address data collection on food insecurity in the province?
Well, I mean, I would say that until we have this problem under control, nobody should be opting out of measurement, right? As long as these numbers are as high as they are, then we need monitoring the problem. And so I would say that it shouldn't even be a question whether or not a province participates in measurement right now. It needs to be something that happens on an annual basis. And if we were to go one step beyond that, I'd like to see people in population health, British Columbia, actually analyzing and working with these data. Perhaps they weren't collected is that there isn't a lot of way in which the province perhaps has been using this information, but that's something else that needs to change, right? Because this information is something that should be informing decision-making. It needs to be collected, you know, rigorously and consistently. There also perhaps needs to be some capacity built in British Columbia so that people in the Ministry of Health and in the ministry, I don't know what it's called in BC, that's responsible for social services and wages, that those people also need to develop capacity so that they can analyze this data and use it to inform their own decisions and to assess the impact of their decisions on this problem.
And Valerie, based on your expertise, just experiences and knowledge in this field of food insecurity, are there specific data that you would recommend to be collected around food insecurity with these surveys? Are there specific questions or targets that you would recommend that are missing in the already built survey?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, the measurement tool that's used to assess food insecurity in Canada is a very well validated instrument, the Cadillac of measurement tools, I would say. No, so I wouldn't say that that needs to be improved. If there's something that British Columbia maybe should add on, it might benefit the province to also introduce questions asking about people's use of food charity or also the use of community food programs, because British Columbia, I think, for a long time has had something called a community food security initiative. There also have been very strong proponents on the national stage coming from British Columbia that are proponents of the funneling of food waste, of corporate food waste into food banks as a way to manage food insecurity. if people think those things are effective responses, I would suggest that they really should be doing some measurement to figure that out. I mean, the research that we and others have done would suggest those are not appropriate responses to food insecurity and that they won't make a dent in these numbers. But given that the province continues to move down that path, I believe the province has been allocating money to food banks even pre-COVID and is doing more now. So if they see this as an effective response, I would say that they also should be asking questions about people's use of food charity. When those two things have been measured simultaneously on population surveys in the past, so what I mean is when a population survey has run questions about food insecurity, but also questions about the use of community food programs or food charities, other research has shown is that typically it's fewer than a quarter of the people who are food insecure that even use those programs. And there's no evidence that program utilization is associated with lesser severity or anything that suggests that those programs are protecting people from going hungry, which is their primary claim. That's what we've seen on the national stage, but British Columbia persists in allocating resources to those initiatives as if they are a serious and effective response to food insecurity. So I would say if British Columbia ever wanted to evaluate the impact of its provincial decisions on this file, they should not only be measuring food insecurity, but also including some questions to ask about people's use of the programs that they're supporting.
Thank you for that insight, Valerie. Again, it goes back to that discrepancy that we see in the general public thinking that having income would mean no food insecurity, which is not the case, as you've just explained, as well as access to these food programs are also not long-term solutions, as you mentioned through your research, for food insecurity as well. Again, it's just bringing to light so many things that I think are solutions that are actually quite contradictory. Valerie, we see that in January 2020, so just about a year ago, the BC government published a report with findings and recommendations from the Food Security Task Force with a goal of leading the province through the next agricultural revolution. And then in response, the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems at Kwantlen Polytechnic University responded to these recommendations with their own report, which included the need for increased food security. What can you tell us about these reports? And what were your reactions to these recommendations and why?
I'm absolutely not an authority on a lot of the issues that were covered in the report that you're referencing, but I was stunned to see the inclusion of a discussion of the Sustainable Development Goal number 2, which is this goal to achieve zero hunger. And I was absolutely stunned to see that included as something that would be addressed through the kinds of initiatives being put forward here. Authors suggested that funneling more food waste to people would somehow reduce food insecurity. And I think that's a very, very, very problematic idea. You made reference to the response that was written by the group of people from the Kwantlen Polytechnic University. I think that's what it's called. They take this on in a way that I won't be able to in the next couple of minutes, but just to say that it's terrible. And this was a provincial task force. I mean, again, you know, this is the province that doesn't measure and seems to think they know the answers. But to claim that moving food waste into programs to distribute to very low-income people would be somehow effective in ending hunger is just ridiculous. I mean, we have no evidence that that's true. It's really a terrible, terrible trivialization of the problem of hunger and food insecurity in British Columbia, because this is a serious thing. You know, I mean, for people not to be able to afford the food they need and for there to be so much evidence now that that is impacting their health and well-being, both in the present and in the future. The idea that you would think that the way to deal with that would be through food waste, it's just unbelievable to me. I'm happy that university produced such a swift and thoughtful response, and they took on many of the issues related to sustainability and other topics that were covered in the report that, you know, I don't have the expertise to do. So I'm happy that that happened. But it's very, very worrying that this report even exists and that the province would have funded something that was so misguided in terms of its treatment of that Sustainable Development Goal number 2. It's absolutely a goal that British Columbia and all provinces and territories in Canada should have at the forefront, no question. But the idea that you can manage that by funneling waste to food charities is just, it's so inappropriate and so clearly not evidence-based. It's shocking.
I'm just going to take some time to let that sink in. If a lot of those recommendations are contrary to the research or from your experiences and knowledge as well, what recommendations would you make? Like, what can we do to address food security in a more robust, sustainable, and inclusive way within the province? And likewise, what interventions are effective solutions to adequately addressing food insecurity in Canada?
You know, the root of the problem is inadequate and insecure incomes. So we need to deal with that, right? I mean, there are other things that cause people to be food insecure, but it starts with people not having enough money to make ends meet, whether they're in the workforce or the other group that are extremely vulnerable that we haven't talked about are people on social assistance. And with income levels that are almost guaranteeing that they will be food insecure because those incomes are so low. So what should the province be doing? Well, it should be taking care of those two things. And how can it do that? Well, there right now in Canada is a growing debate about the value of a basic income or a guaranteed annual income. Dealing with food insecurity is a very good argument for a guaranteed annual income because it would get us to a place of saying we want all people to have enough money to be able to meet basic needs and we're going to guarantee that. So instead of piecemealing out, you know, here's our minimum wage, here's our amount for someone on social assistance, here's our amount for someone who's disabled, here's our amount for someone else, you know, instead of here's an additional amount for someone who's a family with children, you know, instead of dividing all those things up and expecting them in the end to come together to somehow enable somebody to pay their rent and feed themselves and their family, you know, we start by saying, how much do you need to do that right now, given the cost of living here? And then let's put that amount of money on the table. And, you know, on top of that, for sure, make sure that people who work more, earn more money, you know, are able to go above that amount. We wouldn't limit somebody to that amount, but to basically set an income floor below which we wouldn't allow people to go. And I know that the province commissioned some group, I think a couple of years ago, to review this whole question of basic income. And I don't know that there's been a report come from that group yet, but food insecurity is an argument for it because so much of food insecurity is intertwined with public policy decisions right now that relate to income supports that are inadequate or income supports that people can't qualify for. One of the big insights that we have in Canada around what works is what we see happening with seniors in the country. At the point that somebody turns 65 in Canada, no matter how they spent the last 65 years, at the point that they turn 65, they're entitled to an old age pension, and if they're low income, they can also get a guaranteed income supplement and full pharmacare. So at the point that somebody turns 65, they suddenly experience income security with other benefits as well. The amount of money that someone who is an old age pensioner in Canada receives through these basic public programs is more than double that of someone on welfare in most parts of the country. So the difference is gigantic. And what we see when we look at food insecurity rates in Canada, and this has been true for years and years now, ever since Canada started monitoring this problem, what we see when we look at food insecurity rates is that the rates of people 65 and older are very, very low. They're way lower than anybody else. And being reliant on seniors' pensions is a protection against food insecurity. And that's been documented since surveys were run in the 1990s. What we've done is effectively implement a guaranteed annual income for seniors through our old age pension. And it works. It works beautifully. The vast majority of seniors are not food insecure. When we look at very low-income individuals, you know, their rate of food insecurity, their risk of food insecurity drops almost in half at the point that they turn 65. It's a strong argument, again, for thinking about taking that model that we've so beautifully implemented for seniors and rolling it out to people who are younger.
Wow, that's a very interesting point, how you're able to parallel the universal basic income argument along with how seniors are currently already succeeding off of the old age pension. Yeah. That is essentially a groundwork for a basic income, but just on a very specific demographic implemented decades ago that are still very effective to this day. And it's interesting because a lot of the discourse you hear is that CERB is sort of like the testing subject for that basic income. But the senior pension has already shown that for years and years.
Well, and CERB really isn't, because it has so many criteria attached to it, right? So we can find people who weren't able to get CERB, or people still in the workforce and not managing, right? At the point that the federal government announced CERB, I think, you know, many people thought, well, this was a missed opportunity, because during the pandemic, that there would have been a good argument for implementing an income floor and not creating all these contingencies to say, you know, you can only get this if you do that, and you can't qualify for this. And I mean, now, most recently, we've seen CERB replaced by, I think, three benefits, one for somebody who's a caregiver, and one for somebody else who, you know, is sick and needs to take time off work but doesn't have sick days. And, you know, and then we've got this other subsidy. Like, it's very complicated with all kinds of complicated qualifying requirements and applications and things, you know. So I think many people would argue that there was a missed opportunity. We could have implemented a basic income in March, and perhaps then that Statistics Canada survey that looked at food insecurity in May maybe would have come back with different results, right? Conversation's still happening, and we're certainly a long way from being out of this pandemic. I think, as you said earlier, the pandemic has revealed some very significant holes in our social safety net. And one way to think about how to patch them is not to take each little compartment and try to make it better, but to say, we've got a problem with, you know, both people who are not in the workforce and, you know, relying on things like social assistance, but also people who are in the workforce but not able to manage because their income is too insecure and too uncertain, too insufficient at times to meet their basic needs. You know, let's put those problems together and say, what can we do to fix them? Basic income becomes a very compelling story.
I really like how you're tying in all of these different aspects and factors of food insecurity so seamlessly into this argument of basic income, because just going back, even with people who are employed, they don't get some of those, sometimes they don't get those medical benefits. And again,
no, most of the time. I read something recently that over 40% of people in the workforce don't have, sorry, it's less than 40% of people in the workforce who have paid sick leave. So, you know, at a time when we're trying to manage the spread of this virus, certainly in cities like the one where I live, this thing is so out of control. Part of the issue is that people can't even contemplate staying home from work if they're part of this, you know, very disturbing group of workers that are struggling to afford the food they need. It's time for us to think about another way. Food insecurity helps to shine a light on the problem and the complexity of the problem, that it's not just about the inadequacy of social assistance benefits or about the level of the minimum wage, but a whole bunch of things that come together to either enable or prevent people from being able to meet basic needs.
Yes, and Valerie, just kind of transitioning a bit off that topic, can you provide us an example of a place that has implemented these interventions and policies and what those results look like?
Well, I mean, my best example is what we've done in Canada with seniors. I would say that that's the most relevant example for us because it happens in a policy context that is ours. And that's an example that, you know, those seniors' benefits are indexed to inflation, so their protective effect against food insecurity endures over time. When I think about other kinds of programs that we've looked at in Canada, several years back, we looked at the Newfoundland Poverty Reduction Strategy. We saw a profound effect of that strategy on food insecurity rates, particularly those among people on social assistance. And that was really an amazing story, right? We could see a drop of almost 5 percentage points in the rate of food insecurity in Newfoundland and Labrador over a 6-7 year window. But unfortunately, the government changed, the economy changed, things changed, and Newfoundland and Labrador doesn't look so good anymore. And the vulnerability of social assistance recipients that had been diminished so effectively through the changes they've made to the program in that province, it looks like that vulnerability has started to come back up. One of the worries about looking to provincial governments to manage this problem is that their horizons can be quite short, right? That they're working to the next election cycle and they're doing things in a very short-term way. The reason we see such a powerful effect of the old age security and guaranteed income supplement that we've got for seniors is because it's a federally administered thing, and it's been around for a very long time, and it's a part of federal legislation. So it's not subject to change and to kind of the whims of changing governments in the same way that other programs like social assistance and minimum wages and child benefits that are delivered, or rent supplements that are delivered at the provincial level. You know, they can be very volatile things where a province will announce something one day and then it disappears, or it's a one-off, and the whatever the supplement is, it's not indexed to inflation. So, you know, it starts to have a positive effect, but then it's eroded and the government changes, that thing disappears from everybody's memory and we're back to where we were. It's another reason why stepping back from this mishmash of income supports that we've got, particularly as they're administered at the provincial level, and saying, what could we do better nationally and federally? It's another argument for that, I think. Otherwise, what have we got? Crazy things like this report from this task force commissioned by the British Columbian government that's talking about food waste and, you know, the Sustainable Development Goal and hunger, as if those two things somehow come together into some effective and intelligent response. Like, you know, it's just craziness that happens if there isn't a more thoughtful kind of long-term vision of addressing these problems.
So far, you've mentioned a universal basic income where it's indexed to inflation and managing these things on a more federal level for longer term impacts, and also having more robust data collection as well around food insecurity and how that impacts a person and their livelihood. What other policies would you recommend that we put in place to ensure food security across every household?
For me, those are the big ones. Those really are the big ones. The other kinds of things that I think relate to the problem of food insecurity in Canada that we haven't talked about, I think there are two others. One is food insecurity in Canada is racialized. And when we look at who is most likely to be affected, it's Indigenous peoples and people who identify as Black. And there's been a lot of work done over the last few years in Canada to better understand the struggles of people who are Indigenous and to better understand how current conditions of Indigenous peoples relate to colonization and systemic racism and ways in which the exploitation of their natural environments and the 60s scoops. I mean, there's been a lot written. We've got the Truth and Reconciliation Report. We've got the report on the murdered and missing Indigenous women. We've got, you know, there's a lot that's been done over the last, I don't know what, 10 years, 5 years maybe even, to start to kind of talk about how it is that we're where we are now and what needs to change. The fact that someone who's Indigenous has such a much higher rate of food insecurity than a Caucasian in Canada, you know, the European settler in Canada, really speaks volumes to the ways in which the legacy of colonization plays out in this problem. So what else needs to happen is when people talk about the need for Indigenous self-determination, it's important that we recognize that part of that, us talking about a solution to a part of a problem of food insecurity, because there's a need to better understand and to better support Indigenous people to garner their own livelihoods and protect their environments and have more control over their circumstances, so that in ways that enable them to achieve food security. But it's clear that even if we go back to talking about something like a basic income, that makes a lot of sense based on data in the South. But we wouldn't want to say, you know, First Nations should be embraced in that same conversation about basic income. We want to say, what would that look like for you? How does that work, right? I mean, First Nations need to be at the table in determining what the appropriate responses are for them to achieve food security. But just to flag that that's an issue. The other one is anti-Black racism. It makes no sense that someone who identifies as Black would have a rate of food insecurity that was three times someone who identified as white. And we see that every time we look at data in Canada. And that differential is true even after we take a look at things like people's housing and income circumstances. So it speaks to some very, very fundamental biases in our society that enable some people, those who are the privileged white settlers, to garner income in ways that it disadvantages others. So I think the issues of equity, particularly as they relate to race and racism, are ones that also need to be tackled. So, you know, a basic income would go so far, but we still need to deal with systemic racism that prevents people who are Black or Indigenous from accessing wealth in the same way that, you know, that others do.
Thank you for that response, Valerie. That was so rich. And again, you do such a good job of tying in things that people don't typically think of being related to food insecurity, but actually being the foundations of why food insecurity exists. And just based off of those frameworks of the discrimination and comparing those statistics between white settlers and people who have been racialized, especially with Indigenous, First Nations, and people who are Black, those are really troubling statistics. And yeah. I really appreciate your point about bringing in that representation onto the table to talk about why this is the case and what it looks like to adequately have solutions longer term to ensure that this equity model is as robust and sustainable as possible. That's a very, very important issue to discuss and will probably be an entire other podcast episode as well. And Valerie, do you have any further comments or ideas you would like to emphasize to the audience?
Can't think of anything else. We've covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah. Yes, we covered so much ground. I'm so happy that you were so articulate to describe all the topics in just 1 hour. I'm definitely going to have to listen to this several times to absorb and digest all this information.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about these topics. And I hope this podcast is the beginning of a bit of a different conversation about food insecurity in BC.
This is definitely just the beginning, just the tipping point, and it creates such a strong and robust foundation that we need for this conversation too. You've been listening to The Balance, a public health podcast brought to you by the BC Alliance for Healthy Living. The BC AHL was established in 2003, and we represent the largest health promotion team in BC history. Our vision is healthy living for all British Columbians through every stage of life. Our mission is to promote healthy living to prevent chronic diseases by mobilizing key organizations that influence health to collaborate on health policy and programs throughout British Columbia. You can find links to the research articles mentioned in this podcast episode on the show notes. You can subscribe to our newsletter to learn more about healthy living initiatives and what we're up to by clicking on the subscribe button on our website at bchealthyliving.ca or emailing move@bchealthyliving.ca. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Thank you for listening.